Carolina.
No one could be sweeter than McCready when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life around North Carolina's Triangle area, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll be reading more from Heaven for Beginners, Betsy Holloway's reminiscences of her life growing up in Durham. Continuing with Chapter 3, Pleasures Free. My mother didn't work. Having left her job at the hospital a year before my birth, she waited till I entered high school to go back, and even then, she only filled in for others, staying a few weeks or months as she was needed. Instead of working, she managed to keep busy with sweeping and waxing wood floors, dusting and polishing furniture, mopping and waxing kitchen linoleum, vacuuming rugs, washing windows, and scrubbing the bathroom, washing down porches and walls, washing, starching, and ironing clothes, cooking meals and washing dishes, baking cakes, pies, and cookies, canning and freezing vegetables and fruits, and making preserves, jellies, and jams. In addition, she cooked and baked for our neighbors and friends when someone died or was ill, shopped for our household supplies and groceries, sewed dresses, play clothes, and school costumes for me, and mended for all of us, drove me to music lessons, the library, and the children's museum, taught Sunday school and belonged to a church circle, handled the family finances, and drove to and from her father's farm, then a 45-minute trip, at least twice a week, and occasionally every day. To add a bit of extra income to my father's salary, she took in roomers. Sometimes, too, she sold produce from my grandfather's farm, fresh brown eggs, country butter molded into neat round shapes that had strawberries imprinted on the top, and, in December, after hog killing, homemade sausage, fragrant and rich with sage. When she baked, I helped. Determinedly, I creamed butter and sugar for cakes until the mixture became light and fluffy, and my arms ached. Poured oil drop by drop to mix mayonnaise so good that none of us could bear the taste of the commercial kind. Broke the tiny capsule of food coloring inside the plastic bag of Nuco, and then squished, squeezed, kneaded, until the margarine obediently darkened from pasty white to a smooth, healthy yellow. It was my job, too, to pour the cream off each bottle of milk, so my father and mother could have it for their coffee. Chocolate chip cookie dough was mine to mix, as I waited eagerly for the moment when I could pour in all the flour at once, and then stir slowly, until bit by powdery bit, the honey-colored dough reappeared. At Christmas time, I grated coconut for cakes, or helped pull fondant until it became creamy and could be cut into mints, or else folded walnuts and candied pineapple into a small mountain of batter for fruitcake. The aluminum cookie press was most fun of all. You held it at just the right angle to the cookie sheet and moved it slowly along, first turning the knob at the top clockwise and then quickly reversing it to push out the dough into perfectly ridged shapes that would bake golden, delicately edged with brown. One or two afternoons a week, after my mother had finished her housework and cooking for the day, we went somewhere special. Sometimes we walked down Buchanan Boulevard, she on the sidewalk, I balancing on top of the stone wall surrounding Duke's East Campus, to the south end of the campus, where two giant magnolias, their limbs 2 or 3 feet apart, invited climbing. Blithely confident of my sure-footedness, my mother sat on a nearby bench to read, while I happily worked my way up through the branches, occasionally passing a bird's nest, until at 20 or 25 feet, I paused to peer beneath me through the foliage, prudently decided I was high enough, and started back down. Before we left, I checked the sower, the larger-than-life-size statue a few feet away, to see whether any coins lay in the outstretched hand that was just low enough for me to peer into. Usually a couple of pennies rested there, but since I longed to believe they had materialized by magic, I left them alone. Along with its magnolias, Duke offered other entertainment. Each spring my parents took me to the engineering show, where we viewed an assortment of inventions that put the principles of engineering into more or less practical use. We liked the talking garbage cans, but decided television offered little promise. At the women's gym, the Nereidians presented graceful, precise water ballets, and once my mother took me to Branson Theater to see Othello acted in the round. Afterward, trying to find decorous answers to my inconvenient questions, she clearly regretted this excursion into culture. Within easy walking distance of our house stood the East Campus Dope Shop, which mixed some of the best milkshakes around. Once in a while, we went over to West Campus to visit the oddly named Duke Chapel, a cathedral-sized Gothic structure whose front doorway and two windows above formed a great, amazed face. And each Easter Sunday afternoon, armed with our black Kodak, the three of us went in our Easter finery to visit Duke Gardens, walking all the way down the wooded path to the goldfish pond, and then up the stone steps on the other side, through terraced rows of tulips and irises and pansies, past Japanese cherry and crabapple trees, bright yellow forsythia and ethereal white spirea, then past two fountains to the purple wisteria-clad gazebo at the very top of the hill. Outside the gazebo, we all stood solemnly against the boxwoods, so an obliging passerby could snap our picture. Then back down the steps, with a last look at the tulips and the goldfish pond, to return home. If we waited till my father had come home from work, we could use our Plymouth to go further afield. Occasionally, we drove over to Irwin Auditorium, which had been built early in the century as a recreational center for the textile workers living close by in small frame houses that they rented from the mill, 25 cents per room per week. By now, few of the auditorium's recreational offerings remained, except for the small, nearly deserted library. But there, I could dream over L. M. Montgomery's Emily books, with their talented, beautiful heroine, who was mysteriously gifted with second sight. Once or twice a month, we went to Watts Hospital, where my mother happily greeted friends she'd worked with years before, and then disappeared into one of the big open wards to visit a friend or relative, usually discovering in the course of her visit that one or two other acquaintances were on the same ward, and she could visit them as well. Meanwhile, I wandered up and down the hospital's sunny corridors, modestly averting my eyes from the patients who occupied temporary beds in the halls, and peering out the tall windows to look for goldfish in the courtyard's reflecting pools. When 3 o'clock arrived, I climbed the stairs to Ward A, maternity, to gaze through the glass at the new babies. If it weren't too close to dinner time when we left the hospital, we crossed the street to Aubrey's drink stand for a hot dog, or else went to the hospital pharmacy, where we could sit in comfortable booths and have cherry cokes or ice cream. A quick stop by the rolling pin for chocolate eclairs, and then back home, where my father met us as we drove in. To replenish such routine daily staples as milk, bread, and popsicles, I could walk to the Welch's Watts Street Grocery, only a block east of our house, or else to Mr. Gresham's store in back of us. But once a week we took our car to buy groceries at the Piggly Wiggly on Main Street, and then I got to spend a few minutes in Sawyer and Moore, Durham's predominating store, between the Piggly Wiggly and the Donut Dinette. Nominally a drugstore, Sawyer's in fact offered everything from Iodent toothpaste, Blue Horse notebook paper, and Esterbrook pens, to Caranome hand cream, Lilt home permanence, and Musterol. But the store's real drawing card was its soda fountain, and I loved watching the bobby soxers who rushed in after school to crowd into booths, sip on ice cream sodas, giggle, squeal, and flirt. In between observing and eavesdropping, I looked through 17, Calling All Girls, and Screen Stories at the magazine rack. True Confessions and True Romance were there as well, but, of course, you didn't want to be seen buying one of those, and even less did you want to have one in your possession, especially at home. If you weren't obvious about it, though, you could do a good bit of reading while you stood at the magazine rack. The key was to remain standing. Sitting down on the floor telegraphed the news that you were settling down to read for quite a while, and the salespeople didn't like that. Each year, my parents and I went away for a few days during the summer. Once, we went to Nag's Head, where the beach was nearly empty but for a few frame houses on stilts. We rubbed sweet-smelling Gabby suntan lotion on our faces and shoulders each time we went out into the sun, and my father swam his gentle side-stroke and took me out where the sea was calm, to ride the waves before they crashed onto the shore. A few years later, we visited Natural Bridge and Lynchburg, where we stayed with cousins, and I was assigned a room of my own, a charming, oddly shaped upstairs niche. Unable to sleep during that oppressively hot summer night, in desperation I finally got up and pretended I was Heidi, sitting by the window and gazing at the street below. In Richmond, we rode our first escalator. In Washington, we saw The Wizard of Oz, which left me with a penchant for singing Over the Rainbow, in a voice I hoped sounded like Judy Garland's. Each August, my mother and I went to spend a week at my grandfather's farm, where I quickly ran out of books to read, though usually I did succeed in making friends with a cat or two before the week ended. Sometimes we walked up to Little River Church to explore the old cemetery where my great-grandparents were buried, and at least once during the week we drove to nearby Hillsboro, where I gratefully drank at an oasis of books in the tiny library next to the Presbyterian church, while my mother and my grandfather shopped and visited the grocery nearby. And one summer I went home with a friend after church to spend a much-anticipated few days on her family's farm a few miles north of Durham. "Be smart," my father had reminded me, meaning be agreeable, pleasant, helpful, mannerly, as he always did when I left the house to visit someone. And I tried, but though the farm was beautiful, and I dearly loved my friend, I was sharply, painfully homesick, and when her mother hospitably urged me to stay longer, I was polite but firm in my refusal. And once each summer, my mother and I traveled 25 miles southeast to spend a day in Raleigh. From our house, we took an early bus downtown to the mission-styled Union Station behind the courthouse, bought one-way tickets to Raleigh, 35 cents for my mother, 15 for me, and left at 9:15. The train took us through farms and countryside for about 40 minutes before pulling into Raleigh's station. From the station, we walked up busy Fayetteville Street, past Montgomery Ward and the Ambassador Theater, to the Hall of History. There we scrutinized uniforms and weapons from all the wars to which North Carolina had sent soldiers, inspected arrowheads and Indian pottery, puzzled over the fate of tiny Virginia Dare. After leaving the Hall of History, we visited the ladies' room at the Sir Walter Hotel. The Sir Walter, rather than the Capitol, was said to be the center of North Carolina's government. Before going to Woolworth's for lunch, early in the afternoon, we walked back to the State Museum in the old granite agricultural building to admire the mounted animals and the collections of insects, shells, and rocks. Always we ended the day by stopping by the Capitol, a domed, classically styled 19th-century building that wore its years with grace and stood serenely in the middle of Capitol Square, a grassy city block filled with trees, shrubbery, and statues. Tallest, most imposing of all, stood the Confederate Monument, facing Salisbury Street and towering some 70 feet into the air. On Capitol Square we joined other tourists in feeding the pigeons with peanuts that we bought from the vendor for 10 cents a bag, though if we'd thought to supply ourselves beforehand with a bag of cracked corn from Stone Brothers or Barnes Supply, the peanut-weary pigeons ignored everyone else to flock around us. By late afternoon we were tired, and it was time to head for the Trailways station to catch a bus back to Durham, and then a Duke Power bus home. Nothing ever changed on our trips to Raleigh. Each time we went to the same places, in the same order, so I always knew what was coming next. Nothing changed in the places we went to, either. The rocks, shells, and stuffed animals at the State Museum looked the same the last time I saw them as they did the first. Just once, though, we did walk under the oaks on Blunt Street to the governor's mansion, an enormous, many-gabled Queen Anne dwelling of red brick and sandstone that my mother said had been built before she was born. Our timid ring brought forth a pleasant-faced housekeeper, who explained regretfully that no tours of the mansion were scheduled that day. But when my mother murmured that we'd come all the way from Durham, the housekeeper kindly offered to let us look inside a few of the rooms. We walked around on tiptoe and stayed only a few minutes, not wanting, as my mother pointed out, to wear out our welcome. But we did get a glimpse of the high ceilings and elaborate moldings, the ornate mirrors and patterned rugs that filled the reception parlors. Beautiful, we agreed in voices that were suitably hushed. But really, when you got right down to it, not a bit nicer than the Washington Duke Hotel at home. Even before Lakewood Park closed during the 1930s, construction of a new swimming pool had begun on the acreage northeast of town that Brody Duke had given to the city. A project of the Federal Emergency Relief Association, Duke Park Pool was formally transferred into Durham's possession on the evening of 1 August 1934. Mayor Will Carr accepted the facility on behalf of the city, after which former Olympic champion Helen Wainwright Stelling dazzled spectators with her swimming and diving demonstration. The Herald later reported that, at a business luncheon the following day, Mrs. Stelling had delighted members of the Durham Lions Club by gracefully describing the pool as "one of the finest I've ever seen." During the summers that followed, Duke Park Pool opened its gates nearly every day, closing only during thunderstorms or, rarely, though for weeks at a time, when a polio epidemic raged. And, if I didn't go to the Children's Museum or the library, I begged my mother to take me to the pool. When I was little, we went to the small, shallow, fenced-in baby pool. But my sixth birthday made me an adult, for Duke Park's purposes, and then I graduated to the big pool a few hundred feet away. Sometimes Betty Ellington met me at the chlorine-scented bathhouse, where we paid 9 cents each for admission, received in return a wire basket in which to check our shorts, shirts, and sandals, and shared a wooden booth for changing into our one-piece sheared latex bathing suits and matching rubber caps. Robbins was advertising the Stunner, a two-piece style that dipped revealingly an inch below the navel, but with the stern caution that the suit was intended to be worn only in private. And in fact, everyone we saw at the pool was dressed much as we were. Most of the time, though, I went swimming alone while my mother sat and read in the bleachers above the pool. Swimming being a generous assessment of what I did, which consisted chiefly of standing in chest-deep water, peering around nearsightedly to see whether I recognized anyone, and doing deep knee bends to make sure the water came up to my neck. When I did go all the way underwater for a few seconds, it was only after careful preparation, closing my eyes, taking a very deep breath, and pinching my nostrils tightly shut. For a few days I plugged my ears with my little fingers while pinching my nostrils shut with my thumbs, but that soon came to be too much trouble. After watching me spend happy but non-productive afternoons in the pool for a summer or two, my mother decided swimming lessons were in order. Accordingly, she enrolled me in the park's next Learn to Swim course, and on the following Monday morning, together with a dozen other eager learners, I reported punctually and expectantly at the shallow end of the pool for the first class. After checking us off on his list, a bored lifeguard informed us that, on hearing our names called, we were to cross the pool as best we could. When he began reading out names, a couple of boys plunged in to kick and splash energetically across, carefully holding their heads above water. Most of the others in the class met the challenge more sedately, doing dead man's floats with an occasional weak kick or dog paddle to add velocity. On hearing my own name called, I eyed the water warily for a few seconds, summoned my dignity, and began walking cautiously across the pool. Now definitely annoyed, the lifeguard singled me out, along with another girl, for special help, and, while the others received some rudimentary instruction in breathing and kicking, she and I stood attentively and silently against the edge of the pool. I wondered how long it had taken the Nereidians to learn to swim. Occasionally, my companion and I held on with both hands to the trough below the outside edge and kicked vigorously, hoping thereby to appear energetic, even sporty. No one noticed. When the lifeguard returned to us, which he did with marked reluctance, he explained logically and not unkindly that before he could teach us to swim, we must accustom ourselves to putting our heads under water. We were, in fact, to do so right away. His suggestion lacked appeal, and I stood mutely regarding the water for several seconds, hoping vaguely that either the entire situation would miraculously disappear, or the lifeguard would somehow comprehend my fear and find another, gentler method of instruction. While I hesitated, one of the boys in the class tried to speed things up by pushing me roughly underwater. Caught by surprise and terrified as well, I struggled back to the surface, choking, sputtering, and unable to breathe. The lifeguard, doubtless thinking that was plenty for the first day, mercifully ignored me for the remainder of the lesson, and, after my mother had taken me home, I indignantly refused to return to the class the following day, or, indeed, ever again. Thereupon, I determined to learn to swim at my own speed, beginning with daily sessions of bravely immersing my face in our water-filled bathroom lavatory. Over the next few summers, I progressed, by slow, careful degrees, into finally going, voluntarily, underwater at the pool. From that point, I learned to hold my breath in order to float and kick for a few seconds. But I was incapable of summoning the coordination that would enable me to kick, float, breathe, and move my arms all at once. All that kept me going was Esther Williams. I longed to look as shapely and gorgeous as she did in a succession of stunning bathing suits, though I realized her glamorous gold lamé creations would probably never show up in the girls' department at Belk's. I yearned to swim and dive with her easy grace, and especially to be lifted, standing, atop a 20-foot-high fountain. Most of all, though, I envied her gracious underwater smile. While I sincerely wanted to learn to swim, in truth, I was much more eager to learn to smile underwater. Though who I thought would ever be down there to appreciate the accomplishment, I have no idea. Over and over I held my breath, propelled myself firmly down to the bottom of the pool, and parted my lips in what I hoped was a dazzling smile, only to choke instantly and race wildly back to the surface for air. Every time I went to the pool, I kept trying, to the astonishment and alarm of those around me. But a few weeks into each summer, my efforts began to seem futile, and I resumed practicing my basic float and kick across the pool. It was during one of those times that I began to dream, nearly every night, of discovering happily that a singular gift had been bestowed on me. As long as I inhaled slowly and with deliberate care, I could breathe under water. No longer for me the struggle to roll my head out of the water at a certain point in my stroke, breathe in exactly the right amount of air, and exhale it at just the proper rate of speed during the following stroke. I could stay under water indefinitely and tirelessly, breathing in a slow, casual, relaxed fashion, and doing a smooth, perfect stroke and kick that carried me effortlessly the length of the pool in no time at all. The eagerly awaited highlight of Duke Park's summer season came in August, when a cheering, appreciative crowd of several thousand gathered to watch the annual water pageant, a fast-paced show that offered a brass band together with skilled divers and swimmers performing in straight and comic acts. Clowns lost their clothes in mid-air, or went into the pool in flames, or rode a bicycle into the water in a spectacular but ineffective attempt at saving a drowning man. The victim was eventually pulled to safety by a businesslike 3-year-old. Girls wearing seal costumes balanced balls on their noses while presenting a precision swimming act, and champion divers performed double gainers and jackknives that made us gasp. Every year, the crowd left the pageant marveling at the performer's skill. I left it thinking that next year I really would learn to coordinate my motions so I could swim across the pool, and I would definitely learn to smile like Esther Williams. Sadly, my underwater smile progressed not at all. But eventually I did reach a point at which I could dive off the low board and swim hurriedly to the side of the pool. My form, though, remained inefficient and awkward. Years later, when I registered for my first semester at Duke, an advisor informed me that I would have to pass the swimming test, or else take swimming in phys ed. Terrified by the prospect of damaging my budding social prospects by having to attend a semester's classes with wet hair, I reported that afternoon to the women's gym. There, after trying vainly to maintain my dignity in the semi-nude state required for my posture picture, I apprehensively donned my ruffled pink-checked gingham bathing suit, sheared for bosom interest, mentally girded for action, and marched toward the pool. The instructor, a brisk, muscular woman clad in a conservative navy blue mallet and wearing a whistle on a lanyard, surveyed me gloomily before indicating that I could go ahead whenever I liked. After carefully descending the steps into the shallow end of the pool, I proceeded noisily to splash, kick, and flounder my way to the other end. Making a determined lunge for the side as land hove into view, I gasped for breath, tried to seem poised, and looked expectantly up at the instructor, who gazed at the wall. A short silence followed. At last, she pointed out irritably, "You really should take swimming." I concurred agreeably, and inquired, "Do I pass?" She looked depressed. "I guess so." I clambered gracelessly out of the water, dressed, raced back over to registration, and signed up for archery, golf, and ballroom dance before she could change her mind. It was probably my last chance to learn to smile underwater, and I missed it.
I'd make a wish and hear what I'd say. Nothing could be finer than to be a mariner in the morning.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Triangle Yesteryear is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.